The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between David Van Zandt, president of the New School, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer WNYM in New York City.
In a very challenging landscape for higher education, there are certain institutions that seem just right for the present moment. One of those would be the New School, located right here in Manhattan, and who are celebrating their centennial anniversary this year. And it's a great pleasure to have with us tonight the president of the New School, David Van Zandt. Good evening, David.
Good evening.
Welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. Pleased to be here.
Let's begin at the beginning. As I just mentioned, the New School was founded 100 years ago in 1919. What is the founding story of the institution?
It's a great story. It's a very New York story. It's a story of a number of faculty from Columbia University were very upset and concerned about the lack of free intellectual debate there. In fact, at the time, there had been a requirement by the president that all faculty sign a loyalty pledge. This is the time of the Red Scare, the first wave of fear about communism. They came down and said, we want to found an institution that's basically free thought, open discussion of all political perspectives and otherwise. And we wanted to we also don't want it to be hemmed in by a lot of the conservative structures that a place like Columbia or other significant universities have. So we want no buildings. We want no full-time faculty. And we don't want to have an endowment. So and so they started offering offering non-degree, just basically lectures at night to people in the Greenwich Village and in surrounding community. They wanted to be open access in the sense of anybody could come. And if you look at some photos of those old lectures going on, it was really a mixed crowd and probably a lot of Eastern European immigrants, Jewish, otherwise, a lot of women. Mm-hmm. Those audiences tended to be half women. And this was a group that was educated either in the home country or to a certain level here, you know, who just higher education wasn't an option for them. And so that's really how with that idea of free expression or at least open dialogue and debate.
Yeah, it almost sounds like the start of continuing education in some ways.
Well, that's exactly right. That's where a lot of it started in a particular form.
Yeah. Yeah. As part of the rich history of the New School would be the University in Exile, which has now evolved into the New School for Social Research. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it was almost a complete turnaround for the New School because it had started as this place with no degrees, no structures or anything, and just offering courses. In the early 1930s, Alvin Johnson, my predecessor, the first director president of the university, decided as Nazis began to move in Europe that he would try to bring in or rescue as many scholars as he could from Germany and also some from Austria and later from France. And he, with the help of the Rockefeller Foundation and scholars, the Scholars Rescue Fund, began to bring in large numbers of those academics. They were social science academics for the most part. He was he was an economist himself, and he focused on that particular part of academia. And he built up over the years a faculty. It was called the graduate faculty, which there was probably 150 people came through. At any one time, there may have been 30 or so people on the faculty. And they began offering degrees, PhDs, in fact. They moved from nothing to offering PhDs.
Zero to 60.
I always joke, and today if I tried to make a radical move like that, I'd have my head handed to me. But that's, he was quite the innovator and entrepreneur.
Yeah. Some people may not realize, David, that the New School is comprised of five colleges. What would those be?
Well, great. It's evolved over time. But today, what we have is the biggest part of what we are is Parsons, the School of Design, which has some 5,500 to 6,000 students in it. And it offers, bachelor's through a master's degree. Another college is Eugene Lang College. which is a liberal arts college. It's about 1,600 students in it right now. I'm proud to say my wife teaches in that in that college. A third is the New School for Social Research, which was it's sort of what today what the University in Exile was.
Right.
So it's a social science graduate school, maybe 800 students in it or so. It offers masters and PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth is the College of Performing Arts. Now, that's a reasonably new college formed during my time. It was put together from our drama program, our master's in drama program, our jazz program, and as well as Manus, the conservatory. Many people will know the name Manus. Most people don't know as part of the New School. It used to be, when I started, it used to be uptown on the west side. We brought it down, and we integrated the entire campus downtown. The fifth school is, we call it the Schools of Public Engagement. It's a group of different, usually master's level program, but it also has our continuing, our adult bachelor's program for people who've gone to school, some dropped out, went to work, coming back and trying to get their degree. We have a set of management degrees. We have a media studies, a media management program. We even have teaching English as a foreign language.
Quite the enterprise, I might say. Yeah. Who are some of the graduates or people who have passed through the New School since it was founded 100 years ago?
Well, for our centennial, it's been remarkable. We went back and looked at all the people who've gone through. We've got a great video that actually shows many of them. It ranges. Some of our founders were John Dewey, Charles Beard, very famous. Into the 20s, we had people like Henry Cowell, Aaron Copland, composers, major composers. Martha Graham was there for a while. Harry Belafonte took classes there. John Cage, the very creative musician, composer of the 50s, was there as well. So you go back, there's a long list of different people who were at the New School. There were some stars from the academic world as well in the social sciences. Leo Strauss, who's at the University of Chicago, ended up at the University of Chicago, started with us. Claude Levi-Strauss, I'm an anthropologist or sociologist, so I knew that name.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
These are famous names out of academics.
Yeah, it's quite an impressive list. It's been said by you and others, and you kind of alluded to it before, that the New School is unbound by the constraints of traditional university. Speak to that a little bit and how it works to your advantage in the world of today.
I think from the history I just described, you can see it was intentionally unbound right from the beginning. And today, while we offer degrees like other universities and have to be accredited and approved by the state of New York, I think we have degrees of freedom in the sense that it's always been a very mobile place where people coming in and out. We have a large number of people who work in the community who may particularly teach at Parsons, who will have their own business. They'll come in and teach a class. What they do is they bring a lot of the outside world in, which in new ideas and ways of doing things, differently. So there's a general. I think today it's about a culture. It's a culture of innovation. People just don't say, well, we've been doing it that way for 100 years.
Yeah,
let's keep doing it that way. But they're always thinking of new things. Sometimes they work. Sometimes they don't work.
Yeah.
That's the way things work. You don't have this mindset that we have to do one thing all the time. And people are constantly raising ideas, and we're developing programs of different kinds.
Yeah, and you also seem to be a very porous institution. A lot of these institutions sort of have gates around them a little bit. But
that's
you seem to have that, that porousness where the community and the university kind of interact, and ideas are coming in and going out, and it's a flow both ways, which I think is really remarkable.
We're porous both figuratively and as well as physically.
Yes, you are, right.
And so our new building, the University Center at 13th, 14th Street and 5th Avenue, is right on 5th Avenue. That is basically built, designed on the ground floor in particular to be open to the community, and we run over 1,000 different programs every year that are open to the public. And we have some very loyal followers who come all the time, and other people will come and watch events episodically.
Yeah. Let me ask you, David, about one of the biggest issues facing higher education in the U.S. today, and that is the value of higher education. Mm-hmm. As you know, more and more people have started to question the return on investment of a college education. What's the case today for higher education, and is it different than perhaps it was, let's say, a generation ago?
Yeah, I think we're facing a very difficult time as a society. It's not just the United States. It's the rest of the world.
It's You're right.
The same challenge. Today, a higher education, a bachelor's degree, even a master's degree, has never been more valuable at any point in history. In part because more people have them, but also more importantly because in the current economy, in the way the economy has emerged, the people who are very educated get the better jobs. Yet the economy needs better trained, better educated people. And so higher education is just more and more valuable. Our problem, and this is where we get the complaints, is that it's very expensive to do it the way we do it. We at the New School are high touch. Mm-hmm. We run a residential program. It's a full-time program. We pride ourselves on students having people as faculty in their studios at a very low student-faculty ratio, and a lot of colleges try to keep a low student-faculty ratio. But that's very expensive, and costs keep going up. And if you're in Greenwich Village, one of the more costly parts of the most costly city in the world, your costs are very high. And so I think that the people are beginning to question that. And we're seeing a number of colleges around the country close.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah.
And the way I look at it is that the colleges that have some strong differentiator, there's some who have very elite status, who always have a name and a big endowment. They have applications coming out the wazoo, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's the sort of colleges that don't have any differentiating features are suffering, and their enrollment's suffering. My view of this today is a family who has a high school senior says, well, if you can go into one of these either elite or highly differentiated places, we'll pay for it, or we'll work as hard as we can. But you're not going to go to a second-tier school and then we'll pay $60,000 a year to support you just so you can live there and have a nice time. You're going to go to the local community college or state college. So you're seeing also the state systems overwhelmed with students. And that's a challenge we all face. The New School is really well positioned for that just because of what we offer. We offer to a very highly innovative education. Basically, we look at ourselves as preparing people for the creative economy. So we go out and do admissions. We're targeting a very small portion of the population. About 11% of the graduating high school seniors headed to college. We call them engaged innovators. They're people who are extremely creative, but also don't just want to make pretty things, but want to use that creativity to make the world a better place somehow. And that's
what employers need.
And that's
they say the number one thing they need is creativity.
Creativity, right. They need people who are creative in solving problems. And the other thing about our students is they're going to go into careers that are there are many, many different jobs. They're going to have to be resilient. They're going to have to understand how to change with the times. The times are changing much faster than they ever did. We need to prepare students for that kind of world.
Yeah. I think also sometimes people look at the metric of how much money you make coming out of college.
Sure.
And that's maybe not the right metric, because I can't tell you the number of people I know who have taken lower paying jobs because they want to do something which is going to have impact, or they want to get a different kind of experience. But the metric in the narrative right now is this is what college costs, and this is how much you make coming out. And that probably is a very, very short-sighted and limited way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think it's very short-sighted. If you look at the career paths of students coming out of liberal arts colleges, what happens, for the most part, depending upon what they majored in, is they'll start out with a lower salary than maybe peers who went to a business school or more technical type of education. But over the course of their career, their salaries actually go higher, whereas those technical people are sort of – there's a ceiling at which they hit. So I think people have to look long into the future. I do think that, though, that one of our problems is it's because it's so expensive today, there are many people who don't have the luxury of waiting for that time. Their families can't support them for the first few years.
And they got debts.
And they have debts.
Yeah.
Right. And they need to address them. So it's partly – cultural in thinking about it, but it's also some real economics behind it because, and that's the challenge we all face. And the New School started is continuing education for people who, and we are now in our next century moving back towards trying to figure out how to be more accessible to more people.
Let me bring up admission again, because you mentioned that a moment ago. And you, as you know, the admission process of colleges are really under a microscope these days. Perhaps the anti-discrimination suit against Harvard being the primary example. Has your admission policy changed at the new school since you took over? And if so, how?
Yeah, it's certainly changed. We have always had a very diverse population of students. And while you could always do better, you know, I've felt that, you know, we're doing the right things in that area to attract people. I don't know if you know, but all over a third of our undergraduates come from outside the U.S.
Right.
So we're very, which is the largest number in the country. So it's.
Has that been impacted at all by the current climate?
Well, you know, we were quite fearful of that, and we were making plans for, you know, about 10% of our students, a little less, come from the mainland China.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were quite concerned about, fortunately, the last couple of years, it hasn't had that impact. It's had a very serious impact around the country.
Yeah.
I know the University of California system has lost quite a few students, foreign students coming in. For us, I think it's a couple of things. I think it's the value of the education, in particular the Parsons education. It's just the elite, you know, number one in the world. And it's second, it is New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And I think New York City is somewhat viewed as a haven or an island within the craziness the rest of America seems to be.
Well, you know, many high school seniors who plan on going to college are right in the process of making the decision any moment now. What advice would you give them, and what factors do you think that they should really carefully consider, maybe some that they've overlooked, in order to make the best decision?
Right. Yeah, I think they, you know, I think probably the best thing, you get the most out of a traditional college education by being someplace where you feel comfortable,
mm-hmm.
where you have peers around you who you respect and even look up to. You always want somebody there who's going to push you, one of your peers. So I think it's very important to look at that in a college. What's sort of the environment like? It's tough being on the outside and going for one college visit to tell that, but I think that has a lot to do with the long-term success of going to college. In our particular case, you know, we're not for everyone. So, you know, it's a small portion of the population. But the people who are these engaged innovators, you know, we're the ideal match for them and what they want to do going forward.
Let's talk a little bit about the relationship that you have with New York City and that New York City has with you.
Yeah. Well, the New School, you know, was founded right in the heart of New York City years ago. And as I mentioned, it had opened doors in terms of who could come and take courses. So it's always been, in one sense, providing a public service to New York that the other colleges and universities, you know, at least back then, weren't able to do or weren't willing to actually do. You know, and so over the years, we've continued that. We still have a continuing education program that's very strong. Another area where we've, I believe, contributed a lot has been in the public policy area. We have people coming in and out of city government over the years through our Milano School of Public Policy. But probably the biggest impact today is that, you know, New York City, I don't know if people know this, but New York City has more college students in it than Boston does. People think of Boston as being all made of college students, but they are, you know, a big percentage there, but we have more students here. And the other thing we have here is some, you know, very strong industries. Obviously, finance is one. But a big, very, you know, ranking right up there is the creative industry, design. It can be in media. It can be in actual design. It can be in, you know, all sorts of related areas. And, you know, we provide a lot of the talent for that industry in New York. And in an era in which higher education is only more important and employers are looking for people with higher sets of capabilities and skills, in one sense, I think that's our biggest contribution to New York City. New York City is in a great position. It needs to continue to support its higher education institutions. That's the key right now. I mean, that's the key to a city economy doing well is having strong higher education.
Yeah, that's right. And seems to me the key to any city, even New York City, is having young talent.
Exactly.
And if you can supply young talent, you are going to be very coveted and very much
And we get very excited young talent who are coming. I mean, one thing I say, we don't have as many dorms as, say, a Columbia or NYU does. But, in fact, a lot of our students don't want to live in dorms. They want to be in the city. They want to get going. They want to be, you know, living in the city. You know, they're not going to be able to live around, you know, the school itself.
Yeah,
they're living
yeah.
all over the city. But that's the kind of mentality they have. They don't want to be sort of holed up in a dorm or a quad or a small self-contained college.
Ready to go.
Yep,
absolutely.
Exactly.
That's very interesting. What has given you the greatest satisfaction since you started at the New School, and what would you say has been your biggest challenge?
Yeah. I would say the biggest satisfaction has been bringing the university together. You know, it started, it was sort of cobbled together as a group of siloed programs. Mm-hmm. Parsons came in on its own back in 1970. Manus came 1990. And they really didn't interact with each other. Manus was way uptown. I mean, I went up there my first couple weeks of on the job, and they, you know, barely knew they were in the New School. There were a couple signs, but they didn't think of themselves that way. So I think bringing the university together, both academically and physically, has probably been the biggest achievement. And we have a vision of the well-educated student, which is a student who has a strong liberal arts foundation, mm-hmm. knows something about management, and then has a set of skills, whether design or performing arts or something like that, that they can take out into the marketplace. And by getting particularly our undergraduates to move across the different programs, they may come in through a certain door. It may be the Parsons door. It may be the Lang door. It may be the Manus door or the Jazz door. But they end up interacting in the classes. They take the same liberal arts classes. So they have the same foundation, even if their program is less liberal arts than a 100% liberal arts student. So that's been very important. And then we buttress that by physically with the building of the University Center, we brought our Manus downtown. We brought our School of Fashion, which is in the West 40s.
Yeah.
Down to the main campus. Fashion is over 1,000 of our students out of our 10,000.
Right.
And that's a big part of our population. You know, we built the renovated, created the Performing Arts College with its own building on 13th Street. And, you know, those have been it's important to be close physically.
You're absolutely right. You know, there's a lot of highfalutin talk about breaking down silos, but physical proximity is probably
difference.
Number one. You know?
Which is hard to do in a place like New York City.
It sure
real
is.
Estate
yeah,
costs,
yeah, there's a lot of orchestration to make something like that happen.
Yeah, so we're constantly.
A lot of leases, a lot of things, a lot of maneuvering.
Yeah.
And the most challenging?
Most challenging. I say, you know, I think probably the most challenging has been living through this particular period of American history.
Yeah.
You know, I arrived and, you know, we had Sandy, we had Occupy Wall Street going on. We had a
right next door here.
Right, student, yeah. We had a student center. Our student study center was occupied mm-hmm. by a lot of outsiders. And then you had the presidential election, which, you know, it's just for a place like ours, particularly with a large international population, was a real shock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we certainly had many international students who were quite concerned about whether they'd be able to continue their education in the U.S. or whether maybe they shouldn't move. Some of our Canadian friends were very aggressive about trying to recruit them at the time. But dealing with that sort of very high, very hot sort of environment, and our students in particular who care a lot about the world were both concerned and engaged in that. And, I think that's one of the more difficult challenges I in particular face here in New York City. But I think the other college presidents have seen that too.
You know, let's face it. It's a challenge being a college president.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many issues.
Yep.
There are so many constituencies who are vying for your time and attention. Not to mention budgets and fundraising.
Sure.
How do you prioritize, David, and how do you spend your time?
I've always tried to keep my eye on the ball of strategy. What is the institution?
Mm-hmm.
Where is it headed? What do we need to do to get it there? Lots of stuff happens every day that you have to respond to. But the key is not to lose sight on the goals that you actually that the institution has, that you have for the institution. It's the part of the job I like the best too.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about the future of the institution and directing it in a certain direction that makes sense from the way the world is. And it's the thing I try to keep doing all the time, even if I've got some other things that are drawing my attention away.
Centennial anniversaries are wonderful milestone events, and it's really an occasion to appreciate the history of the institution and recommit to the founding values. At mm-hmm. the same time, visioning ahead for the next 100 years and putting some of those plans into action. What are you doing to mark and optimize this once-in-a-lifetime occasion?
Right. Well, it's great. I mean, it's our 100th anniversary this year. We've already, at the start of the year, modified all of our websites and other sort of visual things.
I noted.
We have a series of different events happening at the school during the course of the year. You know, for example, we just had a conference on what democracy means, which seems to be a pretty fitting topic right now. The Philip Glass Ensemble just made us their residents, and they are going to do a concert with our Manna. Actually, our Manna students are going to perform some Philip Glass's Symphony Number 3, I think, and I've forgotten when it is in a short period of time. The real key, though, is the week of October 1st to October 6th, 9th or so, when we will just be open, have a series of events, and I think, at the New School, largely in the University Center, but in other places that will celebrate both our past, but also our future. And that's really important. I think when you're doing a centennial, you need to look back to see where you were.
Sure.
What all the great accomplishments you've had. You also are looking back a bit to see what your identity is, you know, as an institution over 100 years. You get lost in the details of day-by-day living today. What you're looking at, too, is the future. What directions does the university have to go? We're making a big effort. We call it the Centennial Project to try to imagine what the New School will look like in 20, 30, 40 years, what it should look like, where we want to direct it. And the idea behind this, we have all of our, you know, our faculty, our students, our staff, as well as alumni or others will be involved in this process. The key is to look far enough out so people aren't themselves worried about their own situation.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So you'll get much better ideas that way if you're looking far enough out. So we're looking forward to the next, you know, what are we going to do with the next century? What's the New School? What's it going to contribute?
Well, the next century is going to take money, and part of that is the New Century Campaign.
That's right.
Which is looking to raise $250 million. Give us an update on the progress of that effort.
Well, we announced the campaign on January 1st, and thanks to some of our trustees, our alumni, many other donors, we're up to $165 million.
Good work.
So we're well on our way to that, and that is something I hope we'll finish up in the next year and a half or 2 years at most. So.
Do you like to fundraise?
Yeah, well, the part of it I really like is meeting people.
Yeah.
You know, you meet some very interesting people. You learn about their careers. That is the thing that attracts me to doing the fundraising. You get to promote the institution that you love, that in my case, you know, that I feel like I have some responsibility for directing.
Yeah.
So it's a very easy thing. It's a very easy thing to do.
Talk a little bit about the corporate culture at the New School. Is there anything that you specifically do to help shape it and influence? And what do you think makes it such a special place to work?
Yeah. Well, I think we would never call it corporate culture, by the way.
But, right.
But it's, it's the organizational culture, and it's the people come to the New School. It's amazing. I've had a couple of receptions in my home for staff and faculty who've been there, you know, hit certain milestones, 20 years, 30 years. It's amazing the number of people who have been there for a long time. Why? Because they love the mission of the New School. It's not just another job for them. They are there because they're dedicated to the idea of what the New School is. Now, they may not have the same idea that the current administration does at any particular point in time, but they're there on a mission, and I think that makes it a very attractive place to come. And people stay quite a long while. It's not like we're paying, you know, we don't give out stock options and large salaries, but it's, you know, people come because they love being in that environment. And I think what I try to do myself to maintain that is to one, be present as much as possible. Two is to emphasize how we treat each other, whether we're talking about service, whether we're talking about discussion, interaction, you know, treat each other with a respect and civility. You know, those are the things I try to do in order to maintain that good culture.
Yeah, it's a great way to model behavior, and others will take note
right.
and do the same.
Right.
Let me close with this, David. You have decided to conclude your presidency in June of next year after nearly a decade in this role.
Right.
As a person who likes to leave things better than they found them, which I believe you certainly have, tell us how you've accomplished that and what you believe your legacy will have been to the New School.
Yeah, you know, I think the the legacy is, the main legacy is bringing the school together, integrating it in a way it never was in the past. I can't claim to be the one who started that, but I certainly feel like that we have been able to really meet that goal over these last couple of years. We've done it in a very difficult time. We are a tuition-based institution and certainly are always, financially, you have to look at that and watch that very carefully. We don't have a big endowment. So that's been the main accomplishment. One part of that, which I probably haven't mentioned as much, is giving the university an identity with the students. Hmm. Going back to what I said about engaged innovators, saying we're not for everyone. Let's get off this idea that we're just a regular college that, anybody, we take anybody as long as they're, they have good SAT scores and good GPAs. We're focused on a particular kind of individual, and I think that has two impacts. One is that we can do a better job of educating them, and we're contributing to society by educating that portion of the population. But two, we help the students themselves. These are young people who mm-hmm. are finding their way, trying to find their identity. If they, the label of engaged innovator or thinking of yourself in those terms is a very positive way to think about yourself and to start your career. I think far too often in society, particularly in high schools, which are very traditional, the kids who are very creative, who are artistic or very creative, tend to be pushed to the side. Mm-hmm. They're not the ones, on the football team or the debate society, those sorts of things. We've given those a place to come. They may not be as comfortable in a more traditional place, but they are really comfortable where we are.
Yeah, well, it's good to know who you are everybody else know who you are as opposed to try to be all things to all people, which so many institutions do. Well, David Van Zandt, the president of the New School, thanks so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website, some of the information you got there, maybe some of the centennial activities which were going to be occurring.
Yep, go right to www.newschool.edu, and you will see all of our activities posted there. Take a trip through the website, as you should, and I think you can get a sense of the excitement. I'm very proud of the work our people have been able to do on that website. It's a very, as you might expect from a school of creativity, it's very visually oriented.
Yeah, it's great.
Because visual communication is so important today.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating history, and you tell that all there
as
well.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Dave. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.